Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to New Books in History, a channel of the New Books Network. I am Vladislav Lilic, a doctoral candidate in modern European history at Vanderbilt University. In today's episode, I'm excited to host Stephen Press, assistant professor of history at Stanford University. We will be discussing his marvelous first book, Rogue Empires, Contracts and Con Men in Europe's Scramble for Africa, published by Harvard University Press in 2017. This incredibly well-documented monograph follows a paper trail of questionable treaties to discover the rogues or confidence men whose actions touched off the scramble for Africa in the 1880s. Dr. Press shows in captivating detail how private European businessmen and firms produce hundreds of deeds purporting to buy political rights from indigenous African leaders whose understanding of these agreements was usually deemed irrelevant. A system of privately governed empires, some spanning hundreds of thousands of square miles, promptly sprang up in the heart of Africa. These experiments in governance attracted notice in European capitals. The book portrays how the whole dubious enterprise came to a head at the Berlin Conference of 1884-1885, when international diplomacy embraced rogue empires as legal precedents for new colonial agendas, opening up a host of dilemmas about the nature of modern sovereignty and statehood. Dr. Press, welcome to New Books in History, and thank you for taking the time to talk to me about your work.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to join you.
As is customary on our channel, I will start us off by asking you about the genesis of rogue empires. What sparked your interest in 19th century rogue empire building? And how would you define the book's historiographical genre as a work of diplomatic history, new international history, imperial history?
If I start from your last question, I guess I would like to see it as fitting a little bit into all of those genres. To go to the first question, I guess. I became interested pretty early on in my graduate study in places and spaces that didn't quite fit with what I understood to be European and world history. I had a pretty, not that this was a positive necessarily, but I had a pretty Eurocentric view of the world entering into graduate school, and my teachers and advisors and peers quickly expanded my view and my horizons. And one of the things I really took an interest in were places that didn't quite have clear nationalist or territorial definitions. I started fairly early on in graduate school dealing with cases where sovereignty was disputed or contested or shared in some ways. I did some research on the German leaseholds in Qingdao, China. And I did some research on the U.S. leasehold, one could say, in Guantanamo Bay. Over time, dealing with spaces like those in which sovereignty was shared and contested, I started to think about the world's overall, how many of these unusual situations were there. I came to believe that there was a much higher number of unusual cases than was allowed for, and that in fact, if one added them up, maybe even those unusual cases and exceptional cases seemed to constitute a majority in certain circumstances. Mm-hmm. At any rate, I had kind of an abiding interest in colonialism. By the time my formative years of graduate school rolled around, I was definitely interested in German colonialism. I was also interested in world colonialism. And I think from my general reading list, I came across Adam Hochschild's work on King Leopold's Ghost, a very well-known book and really great book, great in a number of respects. I think that book prompted me to look a little bit more into the Congo Free State. And at the same time, still interested in these anomalous situations, I started to wonder about cases in which either traditional states functioned in a rather business-like way, or cases in which businesses functioned in what we regard as traditional state ways or public capacities. King Leopold II, in the case of the Congo, certainly has been said to have been a businessman, and his empire there has said to be kind of the King Incorporated, to go back to an earlier work of Neil Asherson. So Leopold II and the Congo were anomalous in some ways, but because I was simultaneously interested in German colonialism and these strange places around the world, I began to see links. At first, kind of theoretical and kind of comparison contrast like links, and then later on, more links in the chronological and intellectual direction. I started to find documents that indicated that there was a real kind of intellectual tradition or lineage, kind of going back to the days of the East India Company, that stretched through the scramble for Africa. And really, in some senses thereafter, although I thought, I presumed to see in the scramble for Africa kind of the largest case for anomalous regimes of sovereignty in which private companies or individuals took on state functions or functions we would normally ascribe to the state. Having shared those somewhat scattered thoughts, I guess I would say this. Another thing I was thinking about when I started to work on what would be my dissertation and then would be the book Rogue Empires was how there was a bit of a gap also in terms of international history and in terms of legal history between what is usually conceived of as an early modern study, or what was at that time conceived of as an early modern study, say studies of company governments, whether in places like North America or in the Indian subcontinent. You had that kind of world, it was a very exciting world in which a lot of intellectual and legal history pioneering works were coming out. Lauren Benton's, Adam Clulow's, it's a very long list, and I'll forget a lot of names. And you didn't necessarily, I thought, have that same kind of attention paid to, say, the late 19th and early 20th century, although at that time there were works beginning to come out Andrew Fitzmaurice's work and work of some others. From my two cents, I thought it would be interesting to kind of examine cases like Leopold II, which attracted a fair amount of attention in tandem with cases like, say, those of German colonials and lesser known rogues, so to speak, like Luderitz in Southwest Africa. These people get some attention in German history typically, but far less attention in, say, diplomatic history, international history, and legal history. So I thought to some extent there was an opportunity for original work and research there. And that's kind of how I wound up forming a book that, or a dissertation, and then a book that started with these kind of intellectual lineages and wreckages from the East India Company, traced that through some places in Southeast Asia on the island of Borneo, and then ultimately wound up in Africa, mostly sub-Saharan Africa, trying to explore why the scramble for Africa, which we typically think of as beginning in the 1880s, started then and not earlier or later. I presume to kind of identify particular intellectual conjunctures, especially in the early 1880s, that resulted in the scramble for Africa starting then. Certainly, if one were looking at structural factors, one could think about things like the Suez Canal, and there are plenty of other the demise of the Ottoman Empire, and there are plenty of other important structural factors. But none of those, it seemed to me, explain why we particularly had this scramble for Africa beginning, say, circa 1882, 1883, rather than earlier or later. So my rogues or intellectual lineages, I hope, had something to say on that subject.
Fascinating. So throughout the book, you navigate this blurred line between private and public governance. So let's dive right into it. You open the narrative with the White Raja of Sarawak, James Brooke, and the revival of chartered company governance in North Borneo. Would you tell our listeners more about Brooke? What role did his own colonial efforts play in the explosion of private empire making in the last quarter of the 19th century?
So Brooke was not exactly a figure that had been entirely forgotten by the time the 20th century came to an end. Certainly in living memory in places like Sarawak, he is very much alive, so to speak. But I think what struck me was that when I started to examine Brooke, who was kind of in some ways a veteran or an inheritor of the tradition of the East India Company, it seemed to me that Brooke's impact on world affairs was outsized in relation to his historical reputation, which was, as far as I could tell, something of a curiosity to people who weren't specialists in Southeast Asia. Brooke, through various services rendered to the Sultan of Brunei, somewhat disputed services, had come to claim pretty much absolute ownership slash rule, and the slash there is telling, of what would now be the sort of southwestern portion of Malaysia. The world fairly readily and quickly accepted Brooke's claims and ambitions. Unlike, say, Leopold II, he wasn't a terrible, clear-cut villain. Even at the time, of course, there were doubts about his claims to have legitimately acquired authority in a far-flung place as far as Europe was concerned. But he was someone with, I think you could say, kind of a legitimate or abiding interest in actual people, which distinguishes him, of course, from Leopold II and others who followed his kind of intellectual trajectory. At any rate, Brooke was someone who believed kind of in a marketplace of sovereignty, as I think it could be called. He believed that through services and contracts and written agreements in particular, that one could transfer powers to rule quite easily. This was not something that was uncommon or unfamiliar to European intellectual history or European state history. Of course, if one looks throughout Europe, it looks kind of in European annals from the early modern period to certainly through the 20th century. There are lots of agreements that transfer sovereign rights or transfer various authorities, and they do it quite easily, sometimes in exchange for money, sometimes in exchange for concessions or transfers elsewhere. But Brooke was kind of a rogue, it seemed to me, in that he, someone without any particular royal lineage of fairly common stock, I mean, he wasn't exactly coming from poor circumstances, but someone who didn't necessarily have standing in international law, who was not a royal, who did not have any claim to previous state existence or public authority, someone like that was just entering the system and presuming to take on the functions of a sovereign. And this, it seemed to me, was quite unusual. Even in the case of, say, the East India Company, one was dealing with a chartered company, and this had been the case for most private experiments in statehood previously. So to some extent, those ventures were presupposing that recognition from other states and European authorities was necessary for their ventures to be legitimate. Brooke didn't necessarily go about it that way. His source of legitimacy was first the Sultan of Brunei, not exactly a traditional European power, and secondly, recognition from the people he presumed to govern, and then from various entities in the West, like, say, Queen Victoria or the President of the United States, and so on. Recognition which he did get over time. And of course, this combined with his rather romantic buccaneering kind of image, one he carefully cultivated, were reasons I found him a compelling source of study. What I didn't know when I first came across the character of Brooke was how much he had interacted with what we kind of think of as the villains or architects in the scramble for Africa, people like Leopold II. I didn't know until I read more and started to take a close look at primary sources. I didn't know that he had been very much involved as a progenitor and as a model and as a precedent for what would become the scramble for Africa. The missing link, so to speak, was a series of adventurers or rogues who tried to copy Brooke's successful, we could put that in scare quotes, example in other parts of Borneo, northeastern Borneo, and what would now be kind of the southeastern portion of Malaysia. The copycats first did their work there, and then later on kind of proliferated and spread to other parts of the world. And the main part of the world where that took hold was Africa. Sorry to keep going on about Brooke. One of the more interesting phenomena associated with him, I thought, was that he was almost constantly on the verge of financial ruin. He had started with very modest financial means, and it turned out that his attempt to govern Sarawak by himself was very difficult from an economic standpoint. Governance, it seemed, was a losing venture. And not the source of fabulous riches that one and many others did imagine it to be. So Brooke periodically went back to Europe and tried to convince the British government to help him out, in many cases offering to exchange ruling powers for money, especially when he, especially because he did not believe he would be able to rule and govern forever. His imitators and the copycats who came after him, trying to do the same thing, really, provide services or produce documents showing that the powers to govern had been transferred to them for certain parts of the Sultan of Brunei. They talked to sovereigns and leaders around Europe, Bismarck, for example, but there were plenty of others. They tried to kind of hawk their rights. For one, they were hoping to get them recognized and therefore legitimated in some capacity. And also they were hoping to kind of put a clear value on them and maybe even make a pretty handsome profit in the bargain. The idea, of course, that sovereign rights or sovereignty could be leveraged in exchange for money is one that's a little bit, I think, foreign to us at first glance when we think about the modern period, but quite familiar to the early modern period in European history. Certainly, we don't see it as anomalous necessarily to hear that a duke or prince in a particular place saw his dominions as a source of revenue, or even his governing rights as a source of revenue and profit. But, you know, kind of putting it in these naked terms, in the case of a far-flung place, was something these copycats and Brooke, to a lesser extent, did with a kind of lack of caution and lack of politeness. And this was something, again, that I would identify as kind of a rogue activity in the 19th century. You had a lot of interlopers kind of maneuvering in the spaces of international law that dealt with kind of a club of statehood. And this was, I think, you know, probably the most profound legacy of Brooke, certainly outside the island of Borneo. He did really provide a big case and example for introducing new members into the club of states, members who didn't exactly bring credit to the international system.
Yeah, it's a wonderful segue into my next question. From there, you draw an intriguing line between Borneo and the book's master con man, as it were, Leopold II, the King of the Belgians. How did the latter, Leopold, manage to acquire sovereign rights across the Congo Basin? How was the precedent established by European recognition of these private fiefdoms in Borneo used by the European would-be kings of Africa?
Yeah, so, you know, as I think a number of compelling biographies of Leopold II have shown, Hochschild's foremost among them, Leopold II was kind of obsessed with the idea of bringing colonial holdings to Belgium. Throughout his life. Belgium, of course, one doesn't want to get too essentialist about it, but Belgium was a fairly small place, all things considered, remained so, had a number of kind of existential divisions and conflicts baked into its being from the 1830s on. And from the perspective of Leopold II, Belgium could only be made great, really, could only be made the equal in some senses of its European rivals, and could only be protected to some extent through colonial expansion overseas. Of course, in Leopold II's case, his big example was sitting quite close to home, that of the Netherlands. He saw the Netherlands as being wealthy in part and wealthier than its Belgian neighbor because of its extensive colonial history. Leopold II spent his early life carefully studying what he presumed to be the Dutch example. He was fascinated by places like Java, where it seemed like the Dutch colonial empire had grown quite rich in a relatively short span of time and with relatively little investment overseas. From Leopold II's perspective, this was the result sheerly of exploitation. He didn't really see colonial endeavors as a win-win for anybody. Rather, he saw them as a fairly straightforward extractive relationship. He gave no credence to the idea that indigenous peoples needed to be consulted or really kind of governed in any sort of collaborative way. At any rate, Leopold II was not a very well-liked or respected person early on in life. He also had kind of a psychological reason to look for aggrandizement and prestige overseas. Now, initially, he turned his attention, which was something that came as a surprise to me, to Southeast Asia, and to some extent to the Pacific. He was shut out of various locations. He found that his money wasn't really good, so to speak, when he showed up trying to buy sovereign or governing rights. He didn't necessarily use the term sovereignty at that time, which was as it turned out, quite crucial. One of the places he was shut out from was Borneo. He flirted with James Brooke. He flattered James Brooke. He tried to turn Brooke's financial vulnerability into an opportunity for Belgium to step in as the colonial ruler of Sarawak, that being the northwestern portion of the island of Borneo. Brooke had deserved and valid scruples about dealing with Leopold II. Leopold II indicated that he would see the indigenous peoples of Sarawak who had lived under Brooke somewhat, again in scare quotes, harmoniously. Leopold II saw them as would-be slaves. This was not something that was acceptable to Brooke, and eventually Brooke, after having kind of conned Leopold II out of a little bit of money, refused to sell governing rights to him. Leopold II was not one to accept defeat easily. He moved his gaze around kind of almost obsessively and manically to other potential colonial spots around the world. And he was always fascinated with creative strategies by which to acquire control. Belgium, of course, had little in the way of an army and overseas muscle. So Leopold II felt he needed to get creative. Now, the traditional narrative about Leopold II is that he turned to Africa, especially Central Africa, starting around 1876. There's this conference he calls in Brussels with geography. He pretends to have a humanitarian interest, particularly in ending various East African slave trades, which emanated to some extent in Central Africa or kind of had their basis there. He calls this conference. He gets some diplomatic support and legitimacy as kind of a would-be leader of a major European intervention into Africa. But how does that get us to 1884 and 1885, when Leopold II is recognized internationally by powers, including the United States, as the legitimate sovereign authority of a massive area that would be called the Congo Free State, that's later on the Belgian Congo, and today, of course, the Democratic Republic of the Congo. So how do we get from 1876 to that point around 1884, 1885? That was a question I tried to provide an answer to, or a slightly different answer to. And one of the things I found was that after 1876, Leopold starts fumbling around with various agreements, often put down on paper, but one, when combing through the archives, of course, realizes how many of these were forged and or dubious in other ways. Leopold II starts fumbling around with agreements that give him and his agents, often under aliases and kind of a shifting plethora of names, powers of control over roads or patches of land, or in some cases, kind of trade flows. First starting kind of at the western edge of the Congo River in Central Africa, and eventually making their way deep into the Central African interior. So Leopold II's agreements early on are rather understandably contested, particularly by Portuguese rivals, but not exclusively by them. There were a number of nationalities involved from a European perspective in Congo trade by this point. Certainly considered a lucrative area, economically speaking. So Leopold II finds that his agreements don't get all the traction he had expected. And he finds, too, that without, you know, even as much muscle as Portuguese rivals, he's not able to really kind of realize his dreams and ambitions, nightmarish ones, of course, of control in Central Africa. So he's struggling, and I think it's safe to say that he's on the verge of failure by the time the early 1880s roll around. And one of the intellectual forces or legal forces that provides him a rescue vessel is Borneo, and the precedents that are being established and firmed up and kind of advertised to the world as of the early 1880s. So in around 1882, It is in a rather kind of notable turn in the UK. It is the achievement, and again, we can put that into scare quotes, of the then Prime Minister Gladstone to recognize the legitimacy and sovereignty of a Brook imitator in northeastern Borneo. This would become the British Borneo Company, British North Borneo Company, it is recognized as having acquired sovereign rights and governing powers from the Sultan of Brunei via a very circuitous path involving American and German and British adventurers who were direct imitators and competitors of Brooke. Gladstone, who's, of course, in a lot of ways an avowed anti-colonialist, surprises a lot of people by recognizing this new chartered, this new governing company as legitimate and as really a viable option, not just with regard to the British Empire, but with regard to world affairs. Gladstone, of course, is reminded by himself and others of the rather ignominious end of the British East India Company. Of course, after 1857, with a major rebellion having occurred on the Indian subcontinent, the British East India Company is replaced as the main governing agent in British India with the direct rule of the British Crown, at least in theory, although it takes a while for the East India Company to go away. After that point, well, really prior to that point as well, for about the 50 to 60 years prior to 1857, the East India Company and its system of private for-profit rule is identified as a villain in itself. Adam Smith rather famously calls this form of government the worst of all possible forms. So Gladstone and others, after 1857, make no secret of their disdain and dislike for the British East India Company and the kind of private for-profit rule it represents. They see this anomalous kind of sovereignty as part of a problem. That makes it all the more surprising around 1881 and 1882 when Gladstone takes the stance that a new private for-profit governing venture, what I would call kind of a rogue empire in northeast Borneo, is to be approved and sanctioned and even supported by the British government. In this case, Gladstone decides to give a charter to this British North Borneo Company, which is also this rogue empire, so to speak. Why does Gladstone give a charter? Well, a charter legitimates the venture, allows it to raise funds more easily, kind of substantiates its ruling claims, and of course gives this great international imprimatur, so to speak, that of the British Empire, to a fledgling venture. On the other hand, Gladstone says the charter's a positive in that it puts kind of, you know, theoretical limits to some extent to the ruling powers of this private authority. For instance, it obligates the private authority, at least in theory, to take measures to curb and exterminate any existing slave trade in the area. I mentioned those things again. You know, one of the things I had been interested in from early on in graduate school was a kind of regime of mixed sovereignty and this marketplace of sovereignty. You know, one of the interesting points about people like Brooke, again, is that they saw themselves maneuvering in a kind of marketplace. Same thing with the Brooke imitators on Borneo, same thing eventually with the people in Africa like Leopold II. One of the consequences of seeing and recognizing that marketplace was to allow for another path to have these mixed regimes of sovereignty. The British North Borneo Company gets some sovereignty, gets some recognized governing powers from the British government, and in return cedes some measure of that sovereignty, some measure of that control in exchange with the acceptance of this charter. So getting back to Leopold II, he hears of all this. It's reported in the newspaper he carefully reads every morning, which is the Times of London. He realizes that he's got in his hands the best possible, well, the cheapest and least physical possible form of legitimacy. He instructs agents who have been fumbling about with various types of written agreements to try to substantiate their authority and claims to start using the word sovereignty a lot, and to start insisting that they are in fact following the Borneo example, as he sees it, in Central Africa, an example the British have just said is a legitimate and even healthy example. So Leopold II starts to, and again, forgery is the coin of the realm here, in some cases rather brazenly, and in other cases still brazenly, by making edits after the fact to written agreements, kind of emboldening their claims and contents. Leopold II starts to make a big show of parading these agreements around Europe. Often, of course, the actual documents are still kept in secrecy, but for Leopold, the key thing is to use the word sovereignty a lot, to claim that sovereignty is bought and sold, and to claim that he is buying it legitimately from recognized indigenous rulers, many of which have, at best, tenuous or disputed claims and have had very little in the way of a legitimate conversation with Leopold about sovereign rights. So again, kind of summarize here, the key in the transition is to produce these paper documents, which Leopold II calls treaties. He says that he's got agents in this area, of course, for humanitarian reasons, he claims, who are producing these agreements to transfer control, and specifically sovereign control over pockets of territory, to his various, sometimes he calls them companies, sometimes he calls them individual agents, but to his various organizations in Central Africa. And this is something he really starts to do as kind of a transition after around 1882. It is directly tied to this example from Borneo. And he will continue this through early 1884 and even thereafter. And that is something that raises the attention of other rulers around Europe, particularly Otto von Bismarck. And it is an example that, again, will kind of spread and proliferate by virtue of its being compelling and desirable to other European powers.
Yes. So this Borneo scheme, a claim to territory without being financially or legally responsible for governing, therefore, was a very attractive proposition for European states in the 1880s. So in the latter part of the book, you endeavor to explain why Bismarck agreed to Leopold II's questionable claims over a vast amount of African territory. So why was Bismarck's support crucial in legitimizing the concept of rogue empires? And what is your interpretation of the infamous Berlin Conference of 1884-1885?
Yeah, so I mean, I think... If you're approaching the 1880s from a traditional standpoint of diplomatic history, Bismarck was at the time regarded as the most powerful and influential statesperson on the continent. I think there's a pretty strong consensus behind that. If one wanted to do something in Europe at that time, one would of course be well served to have the support or at least acquiescence of Bismarck. All that said, Bismarck was a rather decisively avowed anti-colonialist in regard to what was then the relatively new German Empire. Through the 1860s, German unification had occurred. Of course, this was finalized in 1871. At that very moment, there were rather direct opportunities for Germany to expand overseas as a formal colonial empire. Bismarck consistently and aggressively refused these possibilities. On many occasions, he made direct statements that to the effect that Germany would never, under his watch, have a colonial empire, or that Germany was not ready to have a colonial empire overseas. So he changes his mind in 1884 and 1885 at the Berlin Conference. Out of that, and after that, we get an overseas German colonial empire. For a lot of historians dealing with modern Germany, this remains something of a mystery. How do we go from Bismarck very consistently and aggressively making denying the possibility of a German colonial empire to Bismarck embracing it around 1884, 1885, and embracing it simultaneously with support for Leopold II's venture in the Congo? What do those things have in common, and are there kind of causal links? So what I found when I went looking particularly at primary sources in the German case was that the shift in Bismarck's attitudes owed quite a bit to the Borneo example again. Bismarck had been one of the European statespeople to whom the imitators of Brooke had been trying to sell their claims to govern parts of northeastern Borneo throughout the 1870s. As I said, you know, he turned down a lot of colonial ventures, some more realistic than others. And one of the ones he turned down and that was pitched to him very frequently was the idea that Germany would buy the governing rights acquired by European adventurers, again, allegedly from the Sultan of Brunei in Sabah or northeastern Borneo. Bismarck declined all this. However, it was the idea and the supposed precedent was brought again to his attention with particular vigor after this British moment in the early 1880s when the British government and crown really kind of sanctioned and gave recognition and legitimacy to what became the British North Borneo Company. So really at the same time as Leopold, Bismarck has agents, some formal, some informal, pitching him on the idea of a similar venture. Their focus, the focus of these agents is Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, and the Pacific to some extent. It is no longer Borneo itself as of the early 1880s. The final attempts to sell Bismarck and the idea of a German overseas colony in Borneo occur really in the very early 1880s. After that, the idea is done for. But Bismarck realizes that he has a nice precedent in his hands to do a couple things domestically. Now, one of the reasons he's avoidant or allergic to the idea of an overseas colonial empire is the expense of it. He doesn't see it really as a winning proposition in regard to taxpayers. He's got plenty of work on his hands as he sees it to kind of have the new German empire digest its territorial holdings, which of course include arguably colonial areas within Europe, certainly in the case of Alsace-Lorraine, but also in the case of the eastern reaches of the German empire. This is by no means a settled territory. But Bismarck is pitched on the idea, starting in the early 1880s, with the Borneo example foremost in mind, that Germany can kind of have its cake and eat it too. It doesn't need to really spend much money overseas. It can acquire additional prestige. And importantly for Bismarck, his government, which is very assured in a lot of ways, but struggles especially with kind of popularity in regard to German youth at the time, and does have trouble in Parliament on a fairly recurring basis. Bismarck is convinced, particularly by 1884, that he can kind of channel this colonial cause and mobilize it to his own ends. One of which is for him to remain popular and remain seen as a dynamic leader, and another one of which is to win a particular election that is set to occur at the end of 1884, toward the end of 1884. So Bismarck decides to change his stance on colonialism, to embrace the idea, and to embrace a series of German colonial holdings that are not, in fact, direct holdings of the government, but rather holdings that are sanctioned, as was the case with the British in North Borneo, by the formal German government, but in fact will be run and governed and held in the way of sovereignty by private adventurers and companies. The main sites for his vision are Southwest Africa, today's Namibia, German East Africa, today's Tanzania principally, also German Cameroon, and German Togoland, of course, today's Togo. That is often regarded as kind of a motley assembly. in German history. People who study Germany at the time say, of course, that Germany was a latecomer and that these were in fact kind of colonial scraps. That's true to some extent. Germany certainly was a latecomer. But if you go back to this moment, there's a whole lot of possibility with regard to the map. And in fact, some of what's going on is that private actors, we could call them rogues, are focusing on certain vulnerable parts of the African continent, vulnerable in the sense that they don't have pre-existing European claims that are recognized and legitimated. They're coming to these areas and they're purporting to produce contracts, or in some cases they'll call them treaties, that sign over sovereignty to them in exchange for money or cash payments or services rendered in the way of military support, but more often cash payments. There are German actors doing this. They're doing it somewhat independently of Bismarck, but also at his behest as of, say, early 1884. And they're going to produce a way for Bismarck to say at home, look, I've gotten you, the German people, an overseas colonial empire with virtually no investment and virtually no commitments. If it all works out, great. If it doesn't, nothing really lost significantly in the way of financial or military commitment. Finances and military commitments being two of the principal reasons Bismarck had rejected the idea of an overseas colonial empire prior to the mid-1880s. So Bismarck is looking for ways to legitimate this and looking for ways to pitch it to the German population and to populations around the world. He I think, finds a good context here, a fruitful context, because of Leopold II's kind of frantic and indomitable activity. If Leopold II's venture succeeds and is recognized as legitimate at this time, it will result in more legitimacy and therefore more success for Bismarck's unique colonial experiment. In a sense, Bismarck can say this isn't very unique at all. I'm merely doing as Leopold II is doing, and indeed as the British are doing, and as a host of kind of international actors are doing. So there's a kind of, I guess we could say, honor among thieves, or a kind of intellectual commonality that becomes, or an international legal commonality that becomes in itself an argument for the legitimacy of this venture. And that's one of the things that the Berlin Conference in late 1884 and early 1885 is really about. It's about a shared set of rules, of course, for the carving up of Africa. That's entirely correct as an interpretation. But it's also about a set of rules that privileges and validates a scheme for private rogue actor, you could say, control of various portions of sub-Saharan Africa. This is a scheme that will benefit Bismarck as he sees it at the time. That turns out to be a somewhat erroneous view, but nevertheless, in the spirit of realpolitik, Bismarck gets behind this idea and, in fact, lends the full diplomatic weight of Germany to Leopold II's venture, which quite arguably would not have succeeded without the support of Bismarck against, say, rival French, Portuguese claims and the like. The other actor, of course, at the time that becomes quite important in assisting Leopold II in getting recognized as the sovereign power in what will become the Congo Free State is the United States. They stand less immediately to benefit from an embrace of this sort of series of private states and empires throughout Africa. On the other hand, the United States has been a place that, since the 1830s, has been enthralled by and with the story of adventurers in Borneo. The U.S. was one of the first powers to recognize James Brooke as the sovereign ruler of Sarawak. It is the place from which the initial Brooke imitators come. And it is a place that one could debate the reasons, is quite friendly to the idea of mixing business and governance in sub-Saharan Africa. So that support comes around 1884 and 1885. It is not exclusively European or Anglo-European support. In fact, the Ottoman Empire and the Sultanate of Zanzibar do sign off on this scheme. But what we get out of the Berlin Conference circa 1884-1885 is a recognition and a validation of private colonial governance, for-profit company governance in many cases, or for-profit individual governance in most of sub-Saharan Africa. This doesn't end with the Berlin Conference. Of course, in some ways, we're still living with the consequences today, but rather immediately in the years and couple decades after 1884-1885, we get further imitations of the Borneo example. Everyone in Africa saying, I'm kind of following in the footsteps of the adventurers on Borneo, Brooke and others. And then, of course, following in the more recent and immediate examples of European actors in Africa who've already kind of laid the groundwork. So a trail of imitation emerges. And there are so many examples, there's kind of a cascade of them, that this particular approach to colonial governance in Africa really becomes quite widespread by the 1890s. Now, it doesn't last very long. And in fact, a lot of the European powers that embrace this idea of sort of little East India companies or large James Brooks running around Africa come to understand that this is not, in fact, the situation of minimal risk and maximum gain that they had anticipated. Before long, Britain and Germany and even Belgium to some extent by around 1908, or perhaps earlier, will realize the error of their ways. And even if they don't, of course, by that point come near to really facing up to the problems and serious crimes of colonialism, they do presume to turn around and face what they see as the evil of private or company run or individual run colonialism. So that's one of the things kind of at the end of the book I'm trying to trace. You know, what are the just as there are lineages from the East India Company that to some extent result in the scramble for Africa as we get it in the 1880s, so too there are lineages of the scramble for Africa and this private rogue component that we're still dealing with into the 20th century.
Yeah, a great summary of the book's contribution. Ultimately, how did this anomaly of privately bought and privately run state square with contemporary legal theories of sovereign authority? This is something that you discuss at the very end.
Yeah. International law is not stable or set institution or set of institutions by the 1880s. I mean, one of the important achievements of the Berlin Conference is to show that maybe we can see this as somewhat more positive as a legacy is to show that the international community, which of course is very Eurocentric at this time, arguably remains so, is to be involved and consulted as our international lawyers on how territorial expansion occurs or how governance occurs in various areas of the world. There are international lawyers present at the Berlin Conference, Travers Swiss being one of the famous cases, but not the only one. And to some extent, the conference is kind of a shot in the arm for international law. On the other hand, a lot of what the conference is doing is saying that the work of major international legal scholars, jurisconsults, dating back to the days of Grotius, doesn't really mean that much in terms of practice, but also arguably in terms of theory. So what do I mean by that? You know, from the early days of what we could recognize as kind of modern international law, the foremost minds typically and the most esteemed minds of international law are saying a couple things. They're saying the idea of paying money for sovereignty or trading it for sovereignty or kind of having it exist in a marketplace is bad, is outdated, and is anomalous. And it shouldn't exist. It may still exist kind of in practice in a few places, but hopefully this is all winding down. This is a kind of old patrimonial way of viewing the state and viewing governance, and it's on its way out. Should be, and that demise should happen as quickly as possible. They're saying this in the 1600s, the 1700s, the 1800s, and indeed even in the 1900s. So they're saying something we would identify as valid in a lot of ways, but it's clearly something that doesn't quite take hold or become universal by any means by the late 1800s. You know, in part, what these rogues and people like Brooke are doing is shaking up the world of international law. They are not really paying attention to the ideas about governance and the ideas about treaties that we would like to think are in place. Again, if we think of states and statehood as a kind of club, they're presuming to enter that club or disregard its rules with regularity and aplomb. In the 1880s, that disruption of some of the principles of international law, some of its means and methods, really, I would argue, accelerates and becomes more pronounced. That is not necessarily of long duration. By the 1890s, many international lawyers and jurisconsults who would deny the legitimacy of these private for-profit or rogue empires in Africa are in the ascendant again, and they look correct and validated. But in the 1880s, especially around 1840, 1805, it's somewhat the opposite, I would say. Now, these debates about A, whether this is a good idea, and B, whether it was legitimate, they really continue into the early 1900s. And that's something kind of neat that can be traced in various court cases, panels for arbitration. Really, there continues to be division on the subject of whether this was truly legitimated by European powers, whether the for-profit and private governing ventures in Africa were in fact states, whether they were state-like, whether they were sovereign, semi-sovereign, quasi-sovereign. There are a lot of terms surrounding this. And for a lot of European governments in the run-up to World War I, it becomes, in fact, important and significant to deny that these rogue empires were ever indeed independent of their European home countries. I mean, that's something I really kind of focused on in the German case as I was wrapping up the research for rogue empires.
Mm-hmm. And this also leads me to my final question. How has this project led you to your current research team, namely a reevaluation of Germany's entire colonial venture in Africa?
Yeah, so when I was doing the research kind of on the beginning of the German colonial presence in Southwest Africa, I became really interested in a section of the Namib Desert that was full of diamonds. At the time, in the early 1880s, it was thought, but not proven in any way, that this stretch of territory would yield tremendous diamond wealth. That wealth didn't actually materialize really with any kind of abundance until 1908. But in the meantime, there were various battles and machinations surrounding sovereign rights or ownership of governance in the area that ultimately contained the diamonds. Because of the Borneo examples and the nature of Bismarck's colonial foray in 1884 and 1885, and because of, again, the example of people like Leopold II, there wound up being quite a bit of contest, court cases, criminal cases, and everything else over the diamond wealth that eventually materialized in German colonial Southwest Africa. So that was something really interesting for me. And I thought, you know, these rogue empires, so to speak, are pretty short-lived in the scheme of things, even by the standards of historians who specialize in one particular period. But on the other hand, their intellectual lineage, their legal lineage can be pretty pronounced, pretty disproportionate in some ways. And certainly a lot of the boundaries we have, if we're looking at a place like Africa on the map, are a lingering presence and a lingering testament to the power of these particular empires as they emerged in the 1880s and 1890s. So, you know, in my more recent work, I've been kind of focusing on a commodity chain surrounding diamonds, diamonds that ultimately flowed from German colonial Southwest Africa to Europe and from there on to the United States with a kind of overwhelming regularity in the early years of the 20th century. And I think as with the kind of intellectual lineages of the rogue empires that I was trying to address in that book, I'm trying to look now at the legacy to some extent of the colonial diamond trade and particular flows related to that trade that resulted from this moment in the late 19th and early 20th century of European colonialism in Africa.
And if I'm not mistaken, your current research has already bore fruit. The new book is to be published in 2021.
Yes, hopefully in April 2021, it'll all be physically in print. Yeah, I certainly look forward to having people read and you know discuss that yeah, I guess it's finally out of my hands now. So I will just I will just await the actual publication.
I for one cannot wait to have my hands on it, Dr. Press. It was an immense pleasure talking to you today. Thank you for joining New Books in History.
The feeling is mutual. I really appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.